Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the very groovy Supertone Show. New Order and Blue Monday, released as a 12-inch single on 12th of March 1983 on Factory Records.
That song is immense. I remember being in a club when they first played that. And it was like, what is that? It was incredible. What a soundscape.
Yeah, everybody just leaps to the dance floor. And it's really the first of its type. I mean, it changed things an awful lot. The first time I heard it, because I'm used to listening to Joy Division, you know, and all that earlier stuff, which is sort of a bit indie, it's a bit, you know, dark and all that. And then this upbeat thing came on. And the whole thing is that Bernard Sumner can't sing. Peter Hook Well, he certainly can't play guitar either. Peter Hook can't really play bass. The drummer, you know, is okay, but it was all drum machine. And the thing about this band is that I remember going, because for a time I was working with a company in the UK called Wigwam Acoustics, who were probably the one of the best live sound companies in Europe in the 80s. And I was called out to sort something out at New Order's gig, because I used to do a lot of engineering and stuff for them and stuff. And so I went down there. And I remember walking up to the Apollo in Manchester. And as I came into the doors, I thought, my God, that sounds great. And this very track was playing.
No way.
It sounded unbelievable. I thought, God, what a great band. And I walked in and there was nobody on stage at all. And I went, I walked down the aisles right the way to the front, then round onto the stage and stuff. And, you know, the guy, and you know, I sadly can't remember his name, but he was the keyboard tech, and it will come back to me. And he gave me a couple of their albums and T-shirts and stuff, which are really cool. But he was there, and he was running the whole thing.
What do you mean?
Well, he was all sequenced. So that was it.
What, even the vocals, or just the
sound? Well, no, it was just the thing, because most of it is without the vocals.
Of
it
course. Ding, 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 you know. Of course, okay.
You know, and the bass, that those very simple lines over the top, which is Peter Hook's trademark, and he might not be a great player, but he certainly, you know, it's him, you know. And of course, there was no vocal. But besides that, everything else was going on. And it sounded fantastic. We had a Meyer sound rig in there. It was totally awesome, fiendishly loud. But it just sounded great, you know, because there was nobody playing.
It was really funny, actually, because I remember seeing Hookie. I can't remember who it was now he was playing with at Lancashire Cricket Ground. And I just was giggling because when he plays bass, he's almost like doing the splits. He does this stride pose and he spent the whole gig just in that one position.
Of course.
And then he'd walk to the other side and do the same. And of course, when you don't really know them, you go, what are you doing, man? But I know that he's a really nice guy. And we've got a friend who knows him very well. And she says, you know, Hookie's lovely. And, you know, so it's not personal. But, you know, when you talk about the actual band and how we experience them, that's, you know, you've got to be able to take a little bit of that, because they're in the public eye, aren't they? And that's, you've got to be honest with how you feel about it. But one thing I didn't realise too much was the history of where New Order came from with Joy Division. And so when I looked into it and a little bit more, because obviously we saw the film Control.
Mm,
so you've got
film.
Guitarist Bernard Sumner and bassist Peter Hook. They saw the Sex Pistols in concert and decided to form a band called Joy Division. Mm. And their lead singer was Ian Curtis and the drummer was Stephen Morris. And they released an album called Unknown Pleasures in 1979. And they just finished recording their next album, Closer, when Ian Curtis killed himself, he hung himself.
Mm.
Which is really tragic, and you get to see that in the film, and then you kind of understand. And obviously the band broke up, they were devastated. And then New Order was formed out of the ashes of that band, and they brought on keyboardist Gillian Gilbert.
They're all from Macclesfield, you know.
Are they really?
Just to throw something in there. But anyway, carry on.
So that's their history, and you've got this kind of factory record scene. You've got the Manchester scene as well, haven't you, from what I gather?
Well, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that.
Okay.
In a minute. Yeah.
Well, and of course, and just remember at that time, I mean, I got into Manchester in 1990 when I went to Salford to study media and performance. So that had already kind of been by then, had already happened. And I just remember very much this whole Manchester scene was very much about the blokes. And of course, at the time, I was a folk singer as well as a training actress and singer. So it was. It was a bit of a hard environment for me, you know, coming from Middle Earth, where the Hobbits come from, in Ross and Wye in Herefordshire. So for me, I got to experience that afterwards and in a different way, you know, a different side of the Rubik's Cube than you did.
Well, the thing is, after that gig, I was very fortunate because I got involved with the Hacienda scene, really. And, you know, Mike Pickering and all those guys and people, and he was the main DJ there at the time. And, you know, so I was in the Hacienda a lot. And I was very honoured to be involved with the design and installation of the last sound system that ever went into the Hacienda, a big EV system. And I remember, because, of course, New Order's money were paying for it, because, you know, Factory Records, Tony Wilson, they're always broke, you know, they never had any money. It was unbelievable. Rob Grattan, you know, Rob Grattan, the manager, was a miserable bugger, you know, terribly miserable. Just like the film. I mean, you know, 24-hour party people, it's another great film. It's really good representation of them all, really. But I always, there's two real memories from that. I remember Tony Wilson turning up and listening to it, and he turned up and he had this Japanese suit on, like really slouchy, you know, big shoulders hanging off like that Yamamoto type look. And I remember him looking at me, and he had the 1,000-mile stare. He looked through me because he didn't know what planet it was, never mind where he was.
Ah.
And he didn't even speak to me. I've seen him subsequently and stuff and spoke to him. But on that time, he just walked in, listened, and walked out again. But then, on a separate day, Peter Hooked rocked up and listened to it. And he said, Simon, that sounds great. He said, but it's not loud enough. I said, what do you mean it's not loud enough? He said, well, we need double the amount of equipment in. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I want you to double it all up. And I said, okay. I said, but I can't be responsible. I said, for the, you know, people will go deaf. I think it was monstrously loud as it was, you know. So we doubled it all up on his bequest. And he said, well, anyway, I just need to whip off now and pick the kids up from school. So what he did, he went outside, got in his Ferrari, picked his kids up from school. That's a nice story.
We'll be right back.
Roxy Music, Editions of You from their second studio album, For Your Pleasure. That was released on the 23rd of March in 1973 on Island Records.
Again, the old grey whistle test. When I saw him on that, I was absolutely blown away. I mean, it was very early because, in 73, I was like 15. So right. It was really sort of very influential for me, all this. And, you know, and I saw them all in the silver suits and doing all this stuff. And Brian Ferry on that, doing this on the old wrestle test was absolutely fantastic. Incredibly animated. The first section of it, Brian Eno's playing tambourine. And what it was, it just had a completely different sound because it was glam rock, but not as we know it. It was like intelligent. and the thing is with Ferry, he became a real sex symbol, didn't he? Because he was like a, you know, he was super smooth and all the women just, you know, oh, it's forever, you know. And they were all, you know, legs weak and all that. And in Manchester, I have only been to a disco. Now, this is an admission about twice in my life, right? Both times, well, when I say voluntarily, let's put it this way, without being dragged there, were at Pips in Manchester, and upstairs they had a Roxy room and a Barry room, and that was where I used to go. That was the only place. That twice I was there, and it was you know, everybody was dressed up and all that sort of carry on.
Wonderful.
As Bowie and Roxy. And it was a great thing. And I thought it was a bit camp and really... And in that song when he goes, I hear the sirens wail, woo! It is so camp and so over the top. I didn't know what to do because I was listening to Wishbone Ash. I was listening to Led Zeppelin. And all of a sudden these guys... But I kind of liked it, but it was a secret to me, really. I kept it inside. I thought, well, this is really cool.
Yeah.
But I can't tell any of my mates because, you know...
Do you know, I get that, actually, because, you know, there's that kind of thing with music, isn't it? I can imagine that, because when I remember seeing Brian Ferry, I mean, it was all a bit bizarre, really. I kept looking at him going, it's a bit like watching Sparks, really, kind of same sort of feel, you know, when you look at him. He's very dapper, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Very, very dapper. And that song was written by Brian Ferry. They recorded it at Air Studios, you know, and it went to number 4 in the UK album charts.
I wonder if Sir George Martin dealt with those boys, because that was a studio. Can you imagine those boys rocking up, you know, all with the silver suits and massive platform anyway?
Do you know what really intrigues me, though? You know me now in terms of the story is I love to go back sometimes because we know Brian Ferry personally, not personally, but know of him. So Roxy Music was formed. Now, this is what I really like. It was formed in November 1970 after Brian Ferry lost his job teaching ceramics at a girls' school for holding impromptu record listening sessions.
That's fantastic.
How marvellous is that?
Yeah, it's marvellous.
See, and that's a bit like, you know, when you used to hide your record player in the drawer.
When I was at school,
You know, it's the same kind of thing. So he got sacked for record listening sessions teaching girls ceramics. It's really obscure. So did you know as well that Brian Ferry actually auditioned to join King Crimson at one point as well?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, before they joined, he got Roxy Music. Because after he got sacked, he auditioned for King Crimson because they were looking for a replacement for Greg Lake. But Robert Fripp and Peter Sinfield thought his voice didn't suit the band, but they loved his talent. So that they actually helped him get a contract with EG Records, which is basically King Crimson's management. And they were also managing T-Rex and Emerson, Lake and Palmer at the time.
Ah.
Or subsequently. So this is what I love as well. So do you know how you recruited?
Go on.
Via the good old Melody Maker.
No.
Yep. He basically put out an advert and keyboardist wanted for avant-garde band or something. And it was just so what happened then? So he advertised for a keyboard player to join him and bassist Graham Simpson. And Andy Mackey replied to the advert, but he wasn't a keyboardist. He was a sax player,
an
oboe
right.
player. But he did own a VCS3 synthesizer.
No.
Now, Andy Mackey was a mate of Brian Eno's.
Right.
But Eno They'd met because they were both interested in avant-garde and electronic music, but Eno was a non-musician, but he could operate a synth. And he owned a Revox reel-to-reel tape machine, so Mackie persuaded him to join Roxy Music as a technical advisor.
No.
Oh, yeah. See, this is just a magnificent story. Revelation. So this is how it all started.
Well, this is Brian Eno's last, because the album this is on, it's the last album he was
That's
on.
That's right.
And I love that synth solo in this, you know. And you know, I mean, it's fascinating. Because Eno, I mean, he's one of our favourite people because his connection with Lanois and all that sort of carry on. We love all that.
Yeah.
And you know, and on this, of course, Chris Thomas produced this record. And he produced a lot of the Roxy stuff. And he worked with the Beatles originally, on and off, right, round about the time that Emmerich sort of left, and it was all that sort of period, you know, where he was got in and stuff. But it was, you know, the whole thing, it was an amazing period in music, this 1973, wasn't it, you know?
It was, and also I think Roxy Music, one of the first sort of rock, glam rock bands, or rock bands, as it were, to actually really look at their career in terms of merch and their image and everything. Then they looked at it. They just completely did. They were trying to do that 360 thing where they just looked at every single detail, because I think they were all sort of art school guys, and they were very much interested in the visual consumption as well as the music.
Yeah,
fascinating.
And I think that's why the Eno probably left, because I think he wanted to get into something a bit more cerebral, you know. Anyway. Shapes of things before my eyes just teach me to despise.
You're listening to The Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was The Yardbirds, Shape of Things. 7-inch single released 25th February 1966 on the Columbia label.
It's a good year, that.
In the UK. Why is that, darling?
I was still in the womb at that point.
Were you?
Yeah.
Blimey, well, there you go.
Mm.
Wombing it up.
Wombing the view, not, as it were. Yeah. The Yardbirds.
Hmm.
Now, this is supposed to be, I mean, obviously I'm used to the sound of it now, but this was supposed to be quite a revolutionary, groundbreaking single for them, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I think Jeff Beck said it was the finest moment. I mean, it's Jeff Beck on guitar in that. And, you know, that fantastic fuzz, more fuzz guitar, you know. And it, you know, I think that the more that these shows go on, the more I realised that fuzz is probably instrumental. Woo, ba bum. To the sound of rock and roll music all the way through that 60s and 70s period, you know, and it's just an incredible thing. And Beck, I mean, he's such a remarkable guitar player. And I'm just reading the Jimmy Page book at the moment, the biography, and it does a lot of talk about the Yardbirds because, of course, Jimmy Page joined on bass, then he ended up playing guitar, Jeff Beck threw his dummy out, he left, he came back, there was a time there was two guitars playing, that's Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page, and then eventually Jeff Beck left and it was Page on his own playing guitar, you know, and it was a remarkable story, the whole thing. But this, I mean, to me, I think it's a great sounding record and very much of its time, but it's got a drama about it, hasn't it, you know, that I don't think was around at that time.
Well, some say it was like the first popular psychedelic song with its Eastern-sounding feedback-laden guitar solo and its anti-war sort of pro-environmental lyrics. Mm. So and it had that kind of like, and they describe it as like monumentally fuzz-drenched solo. I love that.
Yeah, well, there's a bit of fuzz-drenched solo. But, I mean, the whole thing, because Jeff Beck used this, he did it on his opening record, Truth, didn't he? He actually re-recorded it.
Yeah.
And it was Rod Stewart on vocals and that thing. And we played a track from that a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? You know,
yeah.
Which was that's a great sounding record, but it was very much a meld because what I didn't realise as much is that after reading this Page book that the Yardbirds, you know, were formed from these great guitar players because Clapton was playing with them at one stage, you know.
Yeah.
So
sounds,
you know,
a bit like John Mayall and his Blues Breakers. Everyone went through the Yardbirds as well.
Sort of, yeah. You know, and Clapton, Jeff Beck, and Jimmy Page all grew up very close to each other. And Glyn Johns, because that's how Glyn Johns, the engineer and producer, that's how he got involved with the whole thing. It's amazing, you know. And it again, it's a scene. It's like a hotbed of stuff going on at that period.
And it's interesting as well. So this went to number 3 in the UK, number 7 in Canada, number 22 in Germany. And it was in the top 10 in the USA and Canada. And the reason why I say the chart positions is because sometimes it's good to just to know which cultures got it, you know, actually connected with the music at that particular time in life. And the context of this whole Shape of Things song was by the end of 1965, the Yardbirds, right, they'd released 3 albums, several singles, but apart from a couple of B-sides, it was other people's, other songwriters, yeah. And it was blues derivatives, and it wasn't their own. And they thought, actually, you know what, we can write, we should be writing. So they started jamming, and then they went to 3 different recording studios, And they started improvising and laying down grooves and stuff, and they borrowed a groove from a jazz track or a bass line that influenced them and stuff. And it was really, it was that. And that, so they were at Chess Studios in Chicago on their first American tour. On the second time, they went back, and then they went to Columbia and RCA. And Jeff Beck was changing guitars a lot, and they ended up blending a lot of the guitar sounds over 2 or 3 takes. But he couldn't quite... He was like a restless doggy in his basket. He couldn't get his solo right for this. And he was saying when they'd actually done the solo, he said there was mass hysteria in the studio. He said they weren't expecting it, and there was just some kind of weird mist coming from the east out of my amp. And Giorgio, the manager at the time, was freaking out and dancing about like some kind of tribal witch doctor because they couldn't believe that he played this incredible solo.
Well, your CD collection looks shiny and costly. How much did you pay for your bad Moto Guzzi? And how much did you spend on your black leather jacket? Is it you or your parents in this income tax bracket? Now tickets to concerts and drinking at clubs. Sometimes for music that you haven't even heard of. And how much did you pay for your rock and roll t-shirt that proves you were there, that you heard of them first? Now, how do you afford your rock and roll lifestyle? How do you afford your rock and roll lifestyle. How do you afford your rock and roll lifestyle? Oh, tell me. Oh, yeah, all right. Oh. How much did you pay for the chunk of his guitar, the one he ruthlessly smashed at the end of the show? And how much will he pay for a brand new guitar, one which he'll ruthlessly smash at the end of another show? And how long will the workers keep building him new ones, as long as their soda cans are red, white, and blue ones? And how long will the workers keep building him new ones,
as long as their soda cans are red, white, and blue?
Hospital bills, and tattoo removal, and dozens of pills. Your liver pays dearly now for youthful magic moments, but rock on completely with some brand new components now. How do you afford your rock and roll lifestyle? How do you afford your rock and roll lifestyle? How do you afford your rock and roll lifestyle? All right. Self-destruction doesn't hurt them. Your chaos won't convert them. They're so happy to rebuild it. You'll never really kill it. Yeah, excess ain't rebellion. You're drinking what they're selling. Excess ain't rebellion. You're drinking, oh yeah, you're drinking what they're selling, oh yeah, oh right, oh yeah, right.
Cake and Rock and Roll Lifestyle. That's their debut single, released on 7-inch vinyl in 1993, and they had a limited run of only 500 copies, and it was also released as part of their debut album, Motorcade of Generosity, on the 7th of February in 1994 on Capricorn Records.
Great record, great band.
I love this band.
We've had some of the stuff on before. The version of I Will Survive is absolutely tremendous, even though it's got a naughty word in it that we are not allowed to say, really. Now, it's being broadcast further afield. But back to Cake. What I love about them is the lyrics. Very, very intelligent, you know. How did you afford that to pay for that bad motor Guzzi? You know, You know, concert tickets and going to clubs, drinking at clubs, great.
And evoking the pictures as well of the old leather. But what I was thinking about is why would, and tattoo removal, or just, you know, tattoos do not belong to the young, just so you know, laddo. You know what I mean? It's like the audacity, honestly, it's like, I just really get my...
Goat.
Yeah,
because you've got to watch those goats.
We were talking about this the other day. It's like, there was no teenage society in the 40s, right? Okay, so like the adults had respect, old people, grandparents had respect, and with the invention of the motor car and suburbia and the Beatles, yes, we know, and all the revolutions that happened,
the 50s
right?
Mainly, in
yes,
effect,
in the 50s. Fantastic. We love it. It's great for emancipation, and we're getting now equality across the board where people are fighting for it, and we're getting more and more equality. But don't disrespect and make people invisible just because they've got a few wrinkles and they're a bit older. They've got stories, they've experienced. And you know what? People don't stop. They're still kids on the inside. They just look a bit different on the outside.
So you're having a go at old McRae here?
I am. I kick his butt. Anyway,
well,
yeah, it just, that does really, but I get that. But it just, isn't that funny how that tattoo removal thing, I thought, yeah, you know, and that's the audacity of the young. Anyway, well, but I can't, right. I like their energy. I'll shut up now.
Good, back.
I know.
Back to the
okay.
track. You've had a rant. That's a great rant.
Well, I do feel aggrieved by it. And it's like, come on.
Yeah.
Just get real, will you? Just get real. You know, you will get older.
Well, let's talk about his guitar.
Okay, let's go to the guitar.
Because I love that guitar sound. It's sort of basic, it's rock and roll, it's very sort of crunchy, and it's like some old big semi-acoustic thing. I still don't know what it is, but it sounds great. But, you know, but as I was saying, I think the lyric is tremendous, and you've picked up on that. But it's that type of what's the word, reaction that he's trying to generate.
Yeah,
you know,
I get that.
And he, you know, with these things, I mean, Leather Sofa's another great one off, and The Distance. There's some great tracks off other albums as well, but they've got this basic style. There's all that, always that mariachi trumpet in there somewhere.
Exactly, which is the other thing that gets me as well.
Yeah, and
it's always winding me up about that.
Yeah, but overall, they're a great band. Somebody we listen to quite a lot, you know.
And also, do you know what I really love? The space in the song. I can hear the diction in his vocals. And yeah. And it's very much, they've mixed it so that you can hear the narrative of the song, can't you, really?
Yeah, well, there's not a lot going on. They produced it as well. And I mean, I'm not particularly keen on the drum set. It's a bit tight and a bit clicky on the
yeah,
snare.
Yeah, you're always a bit susceptible to the drum sounds, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, but the rest of it, I think it's really cool. And I think the later records got, the production was better, even though it's very basic sounding like this, really. But.
Well, this is how they describe Cake. Cake epitomised the postmodern, irony-drenched aesthetic of 90s geek rock. Their sound freely mixed and matched pastiches of white boy funk, hip-hop, country, new wave pop, jazz, college rock, and guitar rock, with a particular delight in the clashes that resulted. They got me.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. Fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. The taste of love is sweet when hearts like ours meet. I fell for you like a child. Oh, but the fire went wild. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire.
I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire, the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Who else but Johnny Cash, Ring of Fire, released as a single in April 1963, and 4 months later on his 16th album, Ring of Fire, the best of Johnny Cash. So he'd done 16 albums by 1963.
Yeah, but he was...
Holy smoke!
Yeah, but he was born a bit early than that. He probably was in his 30s, wasn't he? Something like that.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, you got a point.
What a badass. And as soon as he opens up, you know exactly who it is.
You do, don't you? That's so true.
Of course, that trumpet, of course, after the cake song.
I know. I just couldn't believe it. I've really set myself up here, haven't I, really? Because obviously, it's always this... I've got this... with my acoustic bass, that I'm playing this far acoustic bass, it's so big. It's not funny because we played a gig on Saturday and I have to sit down with it and it's huge. You have to take a taxi down to the end. It's that long. And it's like, and all I'm a sombrero short, basically, of a man. Don't. It's true. And I'm like, but every time I hear these horns, I'm just thinking, oh, man, you know.
Well the other week, because you don't like sitting down playing bass, because you like to dance, don't
That's
you?
That's true.
And you put a strap on it, and I'm not kidding, I was crying laughing, because all you needed is a big sombrero and one of those, like, those little bolero tops. You just could have been there.
Well, I can't play because I can't see. It goes out, it's that deep. It goes far out.
It's a monster. We're just having some cases made at the moment by a company called Scott Dixon. And John Dixon, I was speaking to him, he's a funny guy from Hull. Great flight case. Obviously, we're going to be flying with these very shortly. We'll talk about it in a sec. And we're having to have a special case made, and it's got to be another, it's like another 30 centimetres bigger. It's nearly 5 foot tall, this thing. It's a monster.
It is a monster. Yeah. And I'm only 5'4" and a half.
You have very long arms, though, thankfully. Anyway, back to Johnny Cash.
Yes, indeed.
Ring of Fire.
So he was one of the, do you know, Johnny Cash, I didn't realise this, he's one of the best-selling music artists of all time. He sold over 90 million records worldwide.
Holy smoke.
And you know what? And that's because he's a crossover artist, because he was in country, rock and roll, rockabilly, blues, folk, gospel, even alternative rock. I mean, he crossed over. That was his gift as well, wasn't it, really? From that longevity of his career, he went all over the place with his style and changed it up, changed it down.
Well, when Rick Rubin did, like, the last records he did, when he did, like, you know, Hurt and all that.
Beautiful.
I mean, my goodness me, what a tremendous... But even then, you know, when he was doing this stuff, he was super cool. And his wife, June Carter Cash, wrote this, didn't she?
Yeah, she did with Merle Kilgore.
Yeah.
And they recorded it on March 25th in 1963. And it is one of Cash's biggest hits, basically. But it was originally recorded by June's sister, Anita.
No.
Yeah, and she actually recorded it on her Mercury Records album, Folk Songs Old and New, in 1963. Now, I've got a note on here that says, don't read. Because basically, Johnny Cash... had a dream.
I had a dream.
He did. He'd heard this song, Anita's version of Ring of Fire, and he had a dream. And in the dream, the arrangement for the song included mariachi trumpets.
No.
Yeah. And he said to her, if you don't have a hit with that song, I'll give you 5-6 months, and then I'm going to record it with the horns, with the Mexican horns. And that's what he did. So he dreamt about that arrangement.
Well, the funny thing, that's brilliant. And the funny thing is this was, it was produced by Don Law. And Don Law, he was a British guy that went over to the States, and he was A&R for Columbia and stuff, because in those days, a producer had a slightly different role than producers that you think of now, you know. It was more of an organisational thing and making sure it's sold and making... It was like a more of a business relationship, really, booking all the artists and all that sort of stuff, you know, and the musicians and all that sort of carry on. But yeah, but that's fascinating because he had that sort of, you know, he got the American sound even though he was British. He's obviously got it. Or did he create it? I don't know.
Many mothers sighing. News had just come over. We had 5 years left crying. News guy wept and told us Earth was really dying. Cried so much his face was wet. Then I knew was not lying. I heard telephones, opera house, favorite melodies. I saw boys, toys, electric irons and TVs. My brain hurt like a warehouse. It had no room to spare. I had to cram so many things to store everything in there. And all the fat, skinny people. And all the tall, short people. Many people. Girl my age went off ahead. Hit some tiny children. If the black hadn't pulled her off, I think she would have killed them. A soldier with a broken arm fixed his death of a Cadillac. Cop knelt and kissed the feet of a priest, and a queer threw up at the sight of that. I think I saw you in an ice cream parlor, drinking milkshakes cold and long, smiling and waving and looking so fine. Don't think you knew you were in the song. It was cold and it rained, so I felt like an actor, and I thought of more, and I wanted to get back there. Your face, your race, the way that you talk. I kiss you, you're beautiful, I want you to walk. We got 5 years stuck on by. 5 years, what a surprise. We got 5 years.
Love him. Love, love, love David Bowie. And 5 years, the opening track on his fifth studio album, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. And that was released on the 16th of June in 1972 on RCA Records.
Co-produced by Ken Scott, which, yes, you've read the book recently. I've got to say, Ken, you don't come over too great in that book. You're a little bit full of yourself. But he has produced some great stuff. And this is one of them. Love that drum sound on that. Great sound, you know, great record. Mick Ronson again, coming to the fore. He played piano, I think, on this. I know Bowie played piano on quite a bit of it. Guitar, arrangements, everything. Remarkable musician.
Fantastic. It was all recorded at Trident Studios.
It was,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
And what was quite interesting about this as well, when they recorded Hunky Dory, and straight off the back of that, they were recording Ziggy Stardust, because the band, the backing band with Mick, realised that actually Hunky Dory wasn't very good in terms of being able to play it live.
That's
so right. They needed some live material. So by the time Hunky Dory had come out, they really almost a good two-thirds of the way through recording Ziggy.
Well, you know, and what a fantastic band, because not only Bowie Ronson, but Trevor Boulder on bass and Woody Woodmansey on, you know, on drums. Amazing band. They were great live. I believe, according to Ken, that David Bowie did most of his vocals in one take.
Yeah, all the sessions, apparently, that he worked on, it's like 95% of all the vocal takes were first takes.
Yeah, same with Visconti. I've just read the Visconti book as well, and it talks about him again. Consummate professional, you know, and what a sad loss, because we were so devastated when he died.
And I really get that, but do you know what I really love about the fact is that I'm discovering him in waves as well now, and really appreciating him. And it's funny, because when people are alive, I don't think you're as appreciated sometimes, because it's like, if you can have a cake, you don't want it. It's when you can't have the cake that you go, I like that cake.
But I mean, we're playing all this stuff from our vinyl collection. What we're trying not to do is not play the obvious tracks, because, I mean, that to me is great. You did a great version of this, again on the Whistle Test. Remarkable live, you know. Because that's what we're really into. I love live records. I know you do. And we love playing live. That's our big thing.
Well, that's the thing. And it's very, very exciting news. So on the 3rd of November, we will be headlining at the Wangaratta Festival of Jazz and Blues, just north of Melbourne, in Australia, in our Australian debut, the Starlight Campbell Band. I'm so excited.
Yeah, we can't believe it. So we're flying out there with our Scott Dixon flight case.
Indeed.
Hopefully,
travelling
around
the other side of the world. And we're going to meet everyone, and we're going to have a beautiful time, and we're going to play our music. And I'm just... It's a beautiful adventure, really.
I'm very looking forward to playing with Clayton, because Clayton Doley, who's playing keyboards with us on that gig in Australia, he's probably one of the greatest Hammond players, certainly in Australia. He's an amazing player, a very talented songwriter and musician in his own right. Great guy, you know, and we're very honoured to play with him. You know, and we've got Steve Gibson coming with us, of course, our drummer. So the three of us are going out there, we're meeting Clayton out there and doing a rehearsal, and then we're just going to rock out.
I know. And then after that, we've got 2 weeks where we're touring the UK, and next year it's all starting to stack up a bit as well. We've got great plans, planned as it were. And talking about live, I know that this next track that we're going to play the show out with, actually, because it's the end of the show.
It is.
And so quickly, the housekeeping, as they say, you can contact us on Facebook, on Twitter, at Susie and Simon, and on Instagram.
And the show's available on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes and iHeartRadio.
So we have Mr. Alvin Lee and 10 Years After.
Slow Blues in C. And this, I remember learning this, the whole thing.
And the whole thing?
Me and Fletch, Stephen Fletcher, he's drummer at school, and I used to, we learned the whole thing. And I remember drawing a little diagram of what our stage set would be with all our Marshall stacks and drums and all that sort of thing. It was on the basis of this. Alvin Lee, sadly missed, very influential for me and my peers. Enjoy.